Hi, everybody. My name is Larcia. I'm a really grateful member of Al-Anon. And that's right, I didn't know where I was going, but that's never, ever stopped me before. And anybody who's ever been on a search and seek mission for an alcoholic knows what I'm talking about. So I made it, and I always found him, so I'm in the right place. I really want to thank the committee for asking me to be here today. It's a real honor and a privilege always to be asked to speak at an Al-Anon meeting, and I am really honored to be here tonight. I want to thank Michael for her fantastic talk. I really enjoyed her, and I've heard her before, but she just is one of those people that just is one of the reasons you keep coming back. I want to thank Cliff and Pat for being here, too. Cliff is just about my favorite alcoholic, maybe number 20. But Pat's my real hero. If there's ever an Al-Anon Hall of Fame, she's going to be the first person I vote into that for. Anybody that's married to Cliff definitely needs some kind of ribbon. But anyway, it is a real honor to be here, and I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what it's like for me today. I also want to thank, too, because the committee took us out to dinner, and we had this real nice meal, and about halfway through, Jim was sitting at our table, and a bird flew in the restaurant, and he thought he was having an LSD flashback. And if Bo and I had known that's what he thought, we wouldn't have told him we saw the bird. But but it's a real pleasure when you get to meet new people and talk to other people from out of the area. And it's real neat to come to a place like this because also we got to meet some of the AA speakers, and right away, you know, they were teasing a little bit and joking. And that makes me feel loved. That makes me feel a part of. And it's always just kind of blows my mind when I go someplace. No matter where we go, the love is always there, and when you walk in the rooms and you feel it, then you know you're home and you know you're in the right place, and I'm grateful for that feeling today. Like I said, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what it's like for me today. I'm the oldest of four children. My dad was a master sergeant in the Army, so that made me the automatic corporal of my family, and I was put in charge of I have two younger sisters and a younger brother, and I was just, from as far back as I can remember, I don't ever remember not having siblings. My sister's just 13 months behind me, and I was just always in charge of them, and I had to do what my dad told me to do, and they had to do what I told them to do. And, you know, and my dad ran our family like he ran, you know, his outfit in the Army. He even just referred to us as his outfit at home. We had, you know, room inspection, and we didn't do the dishes. We had KP duty. You know, my dad had bounced quarters. We had Army blankets on our bed, and he'd bounce quarters off of them, you know, and do all that kind of good stuff. So I learned a lot of discipline and a lot of responsibility at a really early age. And I don't ever regret any of that today. You know, I always think if you're going to marry an alcoholic, it's real good training. It came in handy for me anyway. And it was just the way that we grew up. We just grew up with all that discipline, and it was yes sir and no sir. And I don't have too much recollection of my dad ever. I don't even own a picture of him today without him holding a can of beer in his hand. And I never knew that my dad was alcoholic. I never knew that alcohol ever played a part in my life growing up. My dad was just a person who just got drunk a lot, and I just thought that that's what everybody's dad did. I just thought it's just what went on. I didn't know there was anything bad or good or any. You know, kind of feeling about that. That's just what went on in our house. And my dad was a very verbal person. Like I said, he was a master sergeant in the Army, so he had a voice he could just tear the ceiling off of with. You know, and subsequently, you know, we'd be four kids playing out in the backyard, and he'd call us, and instantaneously four children would instantly pee their pants on the spot, you know, just to come in and find out that dinner was ready, you know. But, you know, and another time he'd call you, and you'd come skipping in the door, and you'd get one right across the mouth and not quite know what had happened or why. You know, and again, I never ever attributed that to the fact that my dad drank or anything. For a long time, I lived under the guise that my dad was just a very mean man. He could be very, very loving, but he could also be very, very mean. And it was like either one or the other. There was never any black or white or anything going on in between. It was just the way that he was. And again, you know, how was I supposed to know there was anything going on? You know, sometimes we'd wake up in the morning and there'd be a pyramid of beer cans to the ceiling from the fight that my, or from the party that my parents had had the night before. Well, fight fits in there too, but You know, and again, you know, it was just, it's just what went on. And it used to impress the neighborhood kids. I'd bring them over and they, you know, was like, you know, when you live in army bases, you know, having pyramids of beer cans in your living room is kind of like having a wonder of the world. You know, so it was, you know, there's not much entertainment going on. And we always lived in military housing and we always lived with other military families, you know, and the benefit for me was that my dad was usually the senior non-commissioned officer, which made me the senior non-commissioned kid in the neighborhood. You know, so I was just in charge. I've just always kind of had that deal. I don't ever remember, you know, they joke that I came out of the womb with a with an armband and a clipboard. You know, I don't ever remember being, you know, in school where I wasn't the room monitor or the playground monitor or the cafeteria monitor, because the teacher knew, you know, if she left the room, you know, that I would tell her who did what, you know, and I would write it down. You know, and I found out at a really early age that that's what I'm really good at. I'm really good at watching what other people down, watching what other people do, writing it down and reporting it to the proper authorities. That's just what I do. You know, and, you know, after almost 14 years in Al-Anon, I guess I haven't gotten very good at that, because yesterday in the company I work at, they made me the floor warden. I have a hard hat, a flashlight, a vest, a big orange vest, and they gave me a bullhorn with a siren. I work with all the group vice presidents are on my floor, so they needed someone who could get those guys to go. And so one of the guys from security called me up and said, we know that this is a job for you. And I had to call and report myself to my sponsor. And I'll try and keep working in that area. But it is a lot of fun, and I really like the job. But anyway, growing up in this house, you know, with my dad, my parents did used to fight a lot. And, you know, and what I remember the most is that my dad would get really angry and he'd do these big stomp out things and he would leave. And he'd be gone for 2 or 3 days and then he'd call the house and he'd never want to talk to my mom. He'd want to talk to me, you know, and I'm 4 or 5 years old or something. And he wants to, you know, tell me, you know, tell your mother if she does this and she does that and she does this, you know, that I'll come home. You know, and I'd have to put the phone down and I'd have to walk over to my mom, you know, and I'd say, well, Dad says if you do this stuff, he'll come home. And my mom would say, no, I'm not doing any of that stuff. And then I'd go back and pick up the phone and say, okay, Mom says she'll do everything, you know, and, you know, because I'm a fixer and I got to make everything be okay, you know, because an absolute terrible fear I had as a child was that my parents would get divorced. You know, and the real fear behind that was that my dad would get custody of me. I was just absolutely terrified of that. You know, because he never made any bones about the fact that I was his favorite child, you know, especially the first 3 of us were girls, which was a huge disappointment to my father, but he always accepted me because I was firstborn. And like I say, he made me this little corporal in this family, and he gave me a lot of authority, and he gave me a lot of responsibility. And he was a very, very strict man, and he just did not disobey him no matter what. And I remember one time, you know, he was gone off on maneuvers, and we were thinking that he was gone, we were playing with these children that we weren't supposed to be playing with, and I thought it was safe because he wouldn't catch us at it. But he happened to come home early from maneuvers, and he caught us playing with these kids, and I saw him drive around the corner, and we tried to hide, but there was, you know, he saw us, and we were in trouble, and I knew it. My mother sent for us, and my sister and I were sitting in the living room, and we were sitting in this one chair together, and, you know, and we were just little guys. You know, I was 6, and she was 5, and my dad was standing over us, and he was so angry. He was, you know, we were just in this big trouble, and he's waving his finger, and he's waving back and forth, and he's going, how many times have I told you girls not to play with those kids? You know, and I knew enough to be quiet and say absolutely nothing, but my sister, who's 5, is stupid, and she says 3 times. You know, so, you know, this just incensed my father, because now not only had we, you know, disobeyed a direct order, we had insubordination to add to our charges, and what happened, always happened, is I got my, you know, I always got all the perks first, being the oldest, but I also always got my punishment first, you know, and I'm in the bedroom, and I'm crying, you know, for my whooping, and I'm sniveling, and I'm waiting for my sister Lucy to come, and she doesn't, and she doesn't. I finally get up the courage to open the door and creep down the hallway, and, you know, peek around the corner, and there she is, and she's laying across my dad's lap, and my father is passed out cold. Now, many, many years later, we are adult children. We're talking about things that happened to you when you were kids, as you do when you're adults. And I reminded her how her big mouth had gotten me a spanking, and she'd gotten off scot-free. She says, you just think that's what happened. She says, you got your spanking, and you were in the bedroom, and, you know, a minute or less. She says, I spent an hour and a half trying to get off Dad's lap without waking him up. And, you know, and for Al-Anon's, justice is a real important factor. And, you know, You know, and what I got to learn from that is, you know, justice is always going on. We don't always see it, but it is always happening. But anyway, you know, in this family, you know, I got to watch my mom, and, you know, and as my dad's drinking increased, and again, you know, I never had any idea that it was my dad's drinking that was going on. I just watched my mom really kind of just be quiet and kind of close up and not do too much of anything at all. You know, and we'd be sitting at the dinner table, and my mom would have these, like, epileptic fits, you know, which, you know, she got to the point where she could read when my father was getting ready to explode. And so her signaled us at the dinner table, you know, she'd just make these flinchy, you know, facial things at us, because she couldn't come right out and say, your father's getting ready to explode, please don't do anything, because you know they don't like that. You know, she would just have to make these facial expressions at us, and it would be a signal to all of us that, you know, you don't talk, just look at your plate, don't do anything at all. But if you have four kids at the table, someone's going to do something, whether it's scratching your knife on your plate or tinking your glass or spilling milk or whatever. And something like that would happen, and there'd be this huge explosion, and my dad would just erupt, and all I would know is that a few minutes later, everyone would be in their bedrooms crying and sniveling. You know, and then the next morning we get up, and it would just be like, what do you want for breakfast this morning? And it would be like nothing had happened. And I had the good fortune when I was very early on in Al-Anon to be at an open AA meeting, and I heard an alcoholic share how alcoholism in the family is like having a sleeping rhinoceros in your living room, but everybody pretends it's a coffee table. And every so often, you know, you walk around the coffee table and you just keep going on, and every so often the coffee table turns into the rhinoceros, you know, and breaks everything in the house. And then after, you know, as long as it does its thing, and then it goes back to being a coffee table again. And that's about the best description I can tell you about what it was like growing up in my house. I always knew there was something wrong, but I absolutely never had any idea that it had anything to do with alcoholism. You know, I just thought my dad was mean. I didn't know why he was mean. I didn't know why he was so hateful. It got really difficult to bring friends home from school, you know, so we just didn't do it anymore. Because sometimes you'd bring friends home and my dad would be friendly and nice to him, and other times you'd bring friends home and he would call you stupid and idiot and just give you a real chewing down in front of him. So what you kind of learn to do from that is just not to bring people home anymore, not to let yourself be vulnerable. You have functions at school, or you're getting an award, and sometimes dad comes and he's proud of you, and other times he comes and he's a drunken mess falling all over people. So you learn not to tell him that stuff is going on at school anymore. You don't even sign up to participate in things for fear you'll win and dad will come. You know, and I had absolutely no idea that it was alcoholism that was causing all this stuff going on in our house. I thought he was just mean. I didn't know why he was so angry or why he was so hostile. I just plain old didn't understand it. I remember one time when we were changing duty stations, we'd gone out to California. Well, I had gone with my mom and my sisters and my brother to California to see my mother's family, and my dad was making all the arrangements, and we were supposed to be there for 2 weeks and then fly home. And I remember getting off the airplane and being 8 years old and knowing, having that feeling in the pit of my stomach that my dad would expect a big hug and a kiss from me, and I didn't want to do that. And I remember feeling really awful about that, that there was something really wrong with me, that this was my dad and I didn't want to hug and kiss him. And I had absolutely no idea that it was alcoholism. Absolutely none at all. I just thought he was a mean guy. Anyway, my dad got out of the Army when we were teenagers, and, you know, up until this time we'd always lived in military housing, you know, on the East Coast with the other military families, and when my dad got out of the Army, we moved to California. And you have to know what a culture shock this was to us. You know, coming out to California in the 60s will rattle your cage. And we had absolutely, you know, this was just such a whole new realm and a whole new thing going on. And it was really difficult to date. It was really difficult to bring guys home to meet my dad, because my dad was over 6 foot tall and he had this one eyebrow that he could raise like 6 inches off of his head. And he would stand over these guys, you know, and give them the same old rocking back and forth thing, you know, about what are your intentions towards my daughter, you know, and we're like 14 and 15 years old. We don't even know what movie we're going to see, no less what intentions are. And so guys would take us out, but it would be like, you know, they'd shake our hand at the door, get us home early, and, you know, just say, hey, it's really nice and I like you, but nobody's worth this, you know. And off they would go. And what kind of subsequently came of that was lying and cheating. You know, the only way that we could go out and have fun and do things was just to go out and lie to my dad about what was going on. We were staying the night at girlfriends. You know, my mom helped, you know, maneuver these things and make these things possible for us. You know, and just all the lying and the cheating and the stuff just started going on. But I tell you what I did learn for myself, And, you know, and my reaction, and all four of us reacted very differently to what was going on in our home. But, you know, my reaction was just do the very best you can. Excel in school. Do exactly what you are supposed to be, what you are told to do. Be a rule follower. Do not rock the boat, and no negative attention will come to you. You know, or at least what negative attention does come to you, you know, you can deal with, because that was usually on a group basis, because that would be when my dad was drunk and having these huge explosions, and it didn't matter what you did or didn't do anyway. And so anyway, when I was around 17 years old, I met my husband. You know, I met him on a blind date. And when he came in to meet my dad, I should have known there was something really wrong with him, because my dad liked him right away. But that, of course, went right over my head. And we went on this bowling date with this other couple, and I tried desperately not to beat him at bowling, but it was almost impossible. And, you know, because right away I know all the stuff you're supposed to make the man feel like he's a big hero guy, you know. Well, when he's drunk and throwing gutter balls, it's kind of hard, but I did try not to beat him. You know, and another clue, you know, that should have been, you know, going through my head that there might be something going on with this man is, you know, he was a few years older than me. He was like 23 years old and I was 17, and he'd been married before and he was still living at home with mom and dad. You know, that might have been a little flag, you know, that there was something weird about this person. But, you know, all I saw was just this absolutely wonderful, fabulous person. Because, see, up until then, you know, I'm the rule follower. You know, I just date these little weenie guys that don't do nothing, you know, real boring, nothing people. And you know, and if an alcoholic, you know, of this type walks into your life, I don't know, it just really grabbed my attention. And I just thought he was just the most fabulous thing in the world. And I remember going back to his house and stopping at a liquor store, and he asked me what I would like to drink, you know, and I told him, because I'm a rule follower, you know, I don't drink. You know, the number of times I've had, you know, that I've actually drank, I could count on one hand, and that had always been in the presence of my parents. And, you know, I'm a rule follower. I just don't drink. And I said, so you're just going to have to pick something for us. And he got a gallon of Red Mountain wine, you know, obviously to impress me, if nothing by sheer quantity alone. And we went back to this house, and we played this game, and we drank this wine. And what I remember about that night is how very drunk I got. I got totally blotto drunk. And the second thing I remember about that night is what an absolutely wonderful, fabulous time I had. I just had the greatest time of my life. And even today, when I think back, you know, on that first date that we had, you know, it still makes me feel good. It was just an absolutely wonderful time. You know, and Butch and I pretty much started dating fairly regularly from that point on, as much as you can regularly date an active alcoholic. You know, that's not always easy either. But, you know, my name is difficult, you know, for sober people. And he used to have to write it down on a piece of paper when he would call me. I would always know it was him because there was high as Larsine there, you know, that's spit it out, you can say it. And we started going out. And I want you to know from the very beginning that alcohol and drugs was a part of our relationship. It was basically his part of our relationship. But it was, you know, not anything that he ever hid from me. You know, I can't say that he led me down this path and I didn't know that he drank and I didn't know that he did drugs. He was very obvious. He was very forward with all that stuff. This is who he was. This is what he did. And from the very beginning, you know, it's real important for me today to remember how much I participated in all of that. Because later on, after we were married and the drinking got really bad, and as often happens in the case, when the alcoholic's drinking increases, the Al-Anon's completely decreases, I forgot that I participated in it. You know, that I drank as much as he did, that I got drunk as often as he did, that I encouraged it, that I participated in it. I used to love to take Butch to my little weenie high school parties. My little weenie girlfriends would be there with those little weenie boyfriends drinking their little weenie beer. And Butch liked to drink whiskey, and he'd pour this huge tumbler of whiskey, you know, and do this gum, gum, gum thing, or just drink it right out of the bottle. You know, and these boys, their eyes would get this big watching them. You know, he was their hero. You know, and most of all, you know, important to me was he was my contribution to the party, you know, to the festivities, because he was always good for some bizarre scene or some bizarre act or whatever, you know. And all the girls just thought I was just, you know, that I could handle this guy was just amazing. And, you know, so it was working for me. There was a time when it was really, really working for me. You know, and again, if you'd have asked me when I first come into Al-Anon, did I ever get drunk with him, did I ever do any of that stuff, I would have vehemently denied all of it. I just, you know, and to me that's just the way that my disease progressed. For some reason all that stuff just gets blacked out of me. You know, I have absolutely no idea that I participated in it, that I had any responsibility in what went on. You know, I would have said that he deceived me about his drinking and that he deceived me about the amount of drugs that he took. And he never did any of those things. But I just blocked it out just so I could look good, so I could one more time be the victim and be the martyr. You know, and I had to be in Al-Anon a while and work on the steps, and when they say more will be revealed, those are the kind of things that I've gotten to remember since I have been in the program. I am really, really grateful for that. Because I am a participant in my own life. I always have been. But sometimes I deny that I have anything to do with what is going on, and I don't think that's true in any circumstance. You know, I am responsible for what comes out of my mouth and what I say, and what I see and what I hear. You know, and I'm grateful to Al-Anon for those lessons. I truly am. But anyway, Butch and I were dating, and we were having a pretty good time. Things were going along really well. He was really kind of a disappearing drunk, though. Like I say, they're really hard to keep track of sometimes. And, you know, a lot of times he'd be gone for two or three, four or five days at a whack. Nobody would know where he was or anything. And I'd go out to work in the morning, and there he would be in the sleep in the back seat of my car. You know, he'd have a breath that could knock a camel off of its feet, but I was just always grateful because he came to see me first. That's all I ever cared about, you know, and I never really asked him a lot of questions. I never gave him, you know, the third degree or any of that other kind of stuff. I was just always so thrilled, you know, that he was finally back. And, you know, he didn't do this once or twice. He did it lots of times. I got to the point where I left a blanket and a pillow in the back seat of the car. You know, right away I'm taken care of, you know, and making it be okay, you know, because that headrest, you know, that's not a headrest. That's an armrest, you know, and just doing those kinds of things. You know, we weren't dating 6 months, and I saw that he was having difficulty making his car payments. Now, he's never said to me, "Larcine, I'm having trouble making my car payments. Can you help me?" You know, but all I know is that, you know, after 9 months of dating, I'm making his car payments for him. You know, and again, that wasn't anything he ever did, but see, it was very important to me that everybody else think that he can make his car payments. At least you think I'm a crummy picker. You know, I mean, he's got to look good, and I'll do whatever I have to do to make him look good. Because, you know, Butch has what so many other alcoholics have, and that's the P word, and that's potential. You know, I mean, you can do stuff with these people, but, you know, but the problem with them is they're kind of like Gumby. You get one arm twisted up and the other one goes down the other way, and, you know, and I never knew that's what I was working with, you know. And I knew he had potential. I knew. And I knew that I could fix him. I knew that the right woman would make this man be okay. And, you know, because he'd been married before, and she didn't understand him. And, you know, if she, you know, and I just knew that I could make everything be okay with him. You know, and I'm 17 years old, and I've already got all this, you know, romantic fantasy in my life about how it's going to be. You know, and how it ended up is that I got pregnant. And it's really important that I share this with you too. I was 19 years old, and I became pregnant. And later on, again, when the drinking got really, really bad, you know, I was sure it was because God was punishing me for having gotten pregnant before I was married. And you know, and what I had to learn after, you know, being in Al-Anon for a little while is that if you're going to screw around and not use any birth control, you might get pregnant. It's just a fact of life. I personally like the God is punishing me thing because it's just, you know, if you're going to do the martyr, you need the, you need, if God isn't punishing you, then you can't do the martyr thing. You know, and again, I've always thought I was such a big responsible person. I always thought I was accepting all the responsibility that was going on in my life and his life and everything else. You know, and again, the part of my disease, you know, that half the time I wasn't accepting anything. I was always blaming other people. It's his fault. It's her fault. It's this person's fault. You know, all this is happening to me because, you know, and Butch is drinking and it's gotten so bad and everything is falling apart, you know, and because God is punishing me because I got pregnant. You know, and for a long time that was a really just my biggest, deepest, darkest secret, you know. And as Michael shared earlier today, that's not that big of a deal anymore, and it's not even that it was that big of a deal back then, but what is important today is that it was a big deal for me then. It doesn't matter if you think it's a big deal. It was a big deal for me. You know, and occasionally we would have to go to work functions and I would have to take Butch with me, and all the way to this work function I'd be telling him, "Now if anybody asks you when we got married, you tell them, and in the proper year so the birth of our son corresponds, you know, appropriately, and no one would know this big horrible dark secret." You know, well, I don't know how many parties you've been to, but I've yet to be to one yet where I've said, "I'd like you to meet my husband Butch." They say, "Butch, it's nice to meet you. What year did you and Larcine get married?" You know. I don't know why I think that, you know, that my coworkers were staying awake at night thinking about that kind of stuff, but that's just my sick thinking, you know, that they're watching me and they're thinking about everything I'm saying or what's going on. You know, I joke with them today, if anybody ever does ask him, you know, he probably still won't know what year to tell him. I have personally lied about it so much myself, I don't even know what year we got married anymore. But actually, last Tuesday, we did have our 21st wedding anniversary, and that's a real blessing, too. But anyway, you know, when I was in Al-Anon, in my first year, there was an Al-Anon Family Groups convention that we have every year, and a bunch of the girls, we do this thing where we get two rooms and we cram as many, you know, people in them as we possibly can, and one night when we were having the meeting after the meeting, everyone was sharing about what I assumed was their deepest, darkest secret, and when it came around to my turn, I shared with these ladies how I had gotten pregnant before I was married, and there was, you know, six of us in the room, and it turns out that five of us, you know, had to get married. You know, we decided the sixth was the sickest because she married an alcoholic and didn't have to, and that's still true today, I think. But see, what I got to learn from that was I got to learn some trust, you know, because when I was sitting and we were sitting there and we were having the meeting after the meeting, we were talking about our feelings, and I thought that these women were trusting me with their feelings, and because they gave me some trust, I was able to give them some trust back, and what I got out of that was that this deepest, darkest secret is no longer a deep, dark secret. It stopped being a deep, dark secret that night. It stopped when one more time, you know, someone reached out to me and I was able to reach back to them. To me, that's what this program is always been about, you know, and I always try and keep that in my mind all the time because I am still a sick person and a lot of times things are going on in my life, you know, that I don't want you to know about. And basically, what I don't want you to know about is how badly I am handling them. So I don't want to talk about it and I don't want to share it with you because I know I am not doing what I am supposed to be doing. You know, and I constantly get to be reminded over and over again, you know, that the only way I can get over those hurdles is when I do share with you, when I tell you what I'm doing. You know, and I get that guidance and that love and that support, and it's not necessarily in, you know, that this is what I need to do or this is what I need to do. It's just in the hug that I get from people that says we love you and we care about you and we're here for you. And I'm just so very, very grateful for that. But anyway, Butch and I got married about a month after our son was born, so I wasn't pregnant when I got married either. And I used to brag on that big time too, and it was all a big lie, but I was not. And if you knew the right questions to ask, then you could find out the right stuff. But that's just the way that it was. And up until this time, I want you to know I never, ever talked to Butch about his drinking or any of that other type of stuff until the day after we were married. You know, and I sat him down and I had this, you know, the heart-to-heart talk about, okay, we have a child now, and, you know, I know the party thing was fun and all this stuff, but now, you know, it's time to get it together, and maybe once a month we'll get a babysitter and we'll go to a party, but that's all we're going to do from now on. Now, he nodded his head like this, to me indicating affirmative that he understood what I was telling him. You know, of course, the very next day he was drunk and off and doing his thing. You know, and the very next day the war started. It just absolutely positively started for me right then. I want you to know, you know, I watched my mother for years do absolutely nothing about my dad's drinking or say anything to him about his drinking, you know, so I knew the silent treatment did not work. You know, I want you to know that Butch prayed for the silent treatment. I am so proud to report to you he never got it, not even once. You know, I was just one of those Al-Anons whose mouth was attached to the doorknob. Boy, the minute he came in the door, I was like a little Pekingese dog, just, you know, and I always joke, part of the reason I talk as fast as I do is I only have so much time from when he got home to when he passed out to tell him everything it was I had to tell him. Because God knows I absolutely positively had to tell him. You know, and I was the master sergeant in our house. I was the one taking the roof off, you know. I was the one that the people would say to me, our neighbors would say to me, Larcine, well, God, no wonder the poor guy drinks. All you ever do is yell and scream at him. You know, because Butch just never did anything. All he ever wanted to do was just get drunk and pass out. Now, I shared that one time, and he was sitting in the front row, and some guy in AA was sitting next to him and leaned to him and said, I don't think that's too much to ask for. And I guess it probably wasn't, but it was more than I could give him. because I was angry. There was no way I was going to let this behavior go on, you know, and so I constantly was just, you know, someone has to watch him and tell him and tell him and tell him all the time the things he's doing wrong and what a disappointment he is and what a failure he is and why can't he get this right, you know, and I would have drinking lessons with him, you know, I would set him down in a chair and I'd pour a drink and I'd take a couple sips and I'd look at my watch and go, oh, it's 6 o'clock, guys, time to go home, see you tomorrow, you know, and I'd go walk towards the door, you know. Butch, can you do that? And he'd nod his head, yeah, I can do that. He was always, like I say, he's agreeable, you know, whatever. All he wanted to do was just hope I'd shut up and he could go to sleep. And, but we would just, you know, just those kinds of things were always going on. And I remember one time he came home, and just to show you how drunk he was, he woke me up. And he demanded to have his dinner, which, you know, was really unlike him, because this, again, was the beginning of this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde personality thing, and we were getting a little bit of that Dr. Jekyll guy there, or Mr. Hyde, rather, and he demanded to have his dinner, and he scared me, because he was really kind of forceful, and that's not the type of person that he is, and I kind of scurried off into the kitchen, and you have to know this is 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, so it took me about 5 minutes to kind of wake up and get my wits about me, and remember who he was messing with here. And I made this Mexican casserole that called for one jalapeno pepper, but of course I had a whole can full of them. So I'd, you know, take every single one of those jalapeno peppers and I just put it in this little casserole portion of his, you know. And he ate it and he was so drunk, I don't know why. His mouth must have been on flame and fire from the very first bite, you know. And then he did what I wanted him to do, and that was go in the bathroom and throw his brains up, you know. And I don't know how you are about it, but, you know, I was in bed giggling and laughing because I just get, you know, how, I don't know how you feel when your alcoholic throws up, but when mine does, I just get a warm feeling all over. And I don't know what it is about throwing up we think is going to fix them, you know, but there's just, you know, and I guess Cliff is the one who knows because, you know, Al and I don't like to throw up. We throw up once and we go, oh, cooties, I'm never going to do that again. And, you know, but, you know, and we think alcoholics think like that too, and they don't because Butch has thrown up enough for 100 people, and I don't think he, even today though, it's still, you know, all this time, and even when he throws up today, you know, I don't laugh out loud anymore, but it's still, you know, I don't really feel bad for him either. And, so I still get to work in that area as well. You know, and I've got a friend who always says, you know, alcoholism doesn't knock on your door and announce itself on any specific day. It's just one of those things that just gets progressively worse one day at a time in your home. And that's just what happened in our home. It just got progressively worse and progressively worse. You know, and I always wanted this Ozzie and Harriet existence, you know, and that's what I had hoped that we would have. But the only way that you saw Butch was like Ozzie was you didn't know what he did for a living either, because it was like all of a sudden he was just this non-functioning, you know, alcoholic. I heard an AA share that he was a functioning alcoholic because he had a wife who had a job, and that was about the description at our house. And again, you know, this is my remembrance of what went on. I don't remember Butch working very much at all, but in reality, I know that many, many times that he would go for weeks and months at a time, not drinking, going to work every day, doing his very, very best to put it together and make it all work. You know, and I know that this happened for a fact, but my memory and the way that I look back upon it and how I am affected by the disease of alcoholism is that all I'm getting to the point now is the negative. That's all I can remember anymore is just, if things are good, you cannot enjoy them, you cannot relax, you cannot let down your guard because something is going to happen and it's going to go off again. And you have to be ready. You absolutely have to be ready. And I want you to know that every time, whenever, you know, he ended up having to go out and do his thing again, I was never ready and I was never prepared, and I don't think that you can be. And what I know today is I deprived myself of a lot of happiness and joy that could have existed in our house if I just would have enjoyed it when he was trying to do what he was, hold everything together, and when he was trying to be a good husband. But I could not. I was just always on the edge and just always watching him and always making it that much harder for everybody all the way around. You know, and when, you know, and all the things that happened in our family happened, you know, and that happened in alcoholic families happened in our family. We had all the financial problems. You know, we were 9 months in an apartment and we were 9 months behind in our rent. You know, and the reason we got to stay in that apartment, you know, is because I've become a good liar. I'll do whatever I have to do to survive. I'll do whatever I have to do to keep a roof over our head. And the landlady would call, and I would make up these horrendous stories of things that were going on. And she would be crying, and I would be crying, and we get to stay another month. You know, and that's just the kind of, you know, these are just the little tools you get to pick up along the way, you know, when you're trying to hold it together and trying to make it look okay. You know, because I could never tell this woman the truth. I could never tell her what was going on in my house, because she'll think I'm a bad picker then. She'll think I really goofed up here. You know, and I know that he can get it together if he'll just do what I tell him to do. You know, what I know today is that I don't understand the disease of alcoholism in the sense that I am not an alcoholic. I do not understand the compulsion to drink. I don't pretend to stand before you today in as many open AA meetings as I've been to, as many AA people as I know, as many AA people who have shared with me, do I pretend to understand the compulsion to drink. I do not understand that, because I can take a drink or walk away. And so for the longest time, I didn't understand alcoholism, period, and I didn't think that alcohol was the problem so much as his inability to control himself, you know, to be responsible. You know, always, if he loved us enough, if he cared about us enough, he wouldn't do this. Why would he keep doing this to us over and over again? And for a long time, I functioned under the fact that he was having a great time out there. I thought he was really having the time of his life, and I thought he was drinking at me. I thought he was drinking to hurt me. And for a long time, I just went on with that kind of a thinking. And when you're thinking like that, then my only reaction was just anger and resentment and hatred. And that's just where all of this just started welling up in me all the time, where that's just all I was just one angry person 24 hours a day. And if I wasn't totally in a rage, then I was just totally exhausted. We have tons of pictures of me after work curled up in the fetal position. Because when you're that mad all day, all of a sudden something just goes poof, and then you just got to kind of roll up for a while and then restore all that anger again. You know, and he was always, you know, and he was my button pusher. He knew exactly how to act or what to do or whatever. And what I found happening to me is what I found happening to my mother. I got to the point where I could read when he wanted to go out and get drunk, when he wanted just, you know, to have a good fight so he could go stomp out the door. You know, and I started trying to make everything perfect so he couldn't do those kinds of things anymore. You know, and I want you to know my husband has gone out and gotten drunk because I've served canned peas for dinner, because I put because I put Miracle Whip on a sandwich instead of Best Foods, you know, for just ridiculous reasons, you know. And I really believe that these were true things. You know, I was in Al-Anon 6 years before I could even look at canned peas. You know, I mean, I just thought that this, you know, because that's just how warped the whole family becomes. I start believing the garbage that he's filling to me, because I need some sort of justification for why all this craziness is going on in our house. We were married a few years, and I thought, obviously, you know, we'd had this really one bad experience where these people, who I affectionately refer to as scum of the earth, they were Butch's friends, had called me on the telephone, and they kicked him out of their house. And they told me that if I didn't come get him, they were going to call the police. You know, and these were some pretty, you know, they just weren't the nicest people in the world, but, you know, they were some, you know, heavy drug use and all that stuff going on over there. And I remember putting our son in the car and going over to get him, and he was just so drunk, and he wanted to drive like they always do, but I just pushed him, you know, and he landed in the back seat of the car. And I drove him home, and I put our son up in his bed, and I came back downstairs, and he tried to get out of the car without my help, and he fell in the street and broke his head open, you know, and blood was gushing out all over and stuff. Now, I'd like you to tell you how concerned I was for his well-being, but my main concern was that the neighbors would see him, you know, and I'm trying to drag him in the house any way I possibly can. And this man happened to be driving down the street and saw that we were having this problem, and he offered to help me, and we lived in a townhouse, and for whatever reason, the bedroom was upstairs, and if you're injured, that's where you belong, in the bedroom, so I had to have him upstairs in the bedroom. I got him up there, and this man didn't take him too long to figure out how drunk Butch was, and he got up right away, and, you know, he left, and blood is just gushing out of his head, and I'm just beside myself. I'm hysterical, so I'm calling 911, and I'm calling my mother, and gosh, I was just high drama everywhere and stuff. Now, calling 911, because I was so hysterical, you know, they had, you know, no idea what was going on. So they sent like a hook and ladder truck and the paramedics and the Redondo Beach police, everybody, everything they had came out to my house. My mother was there, everybody was there. You know, and I'm in the bedroom and I'm sobbing, you know, hysterically. I'm in my son's bedroom and my mom's trying to console me, and the police come in and tell me that my husband said he was injured because I pushed him down the flight of stairs, and that's how he cracked his head open. You know, and I told the police I hadn't done that, but if they'd prop them up, I'd be happy to push them down in front of them. And they said that wouldn't be necessary, but after they cleaned him all up, he has this little weenie cut, just needs a few stitches, but he's so drunk they have to take him by ambulance. Now, I don't know how your neighborhood is, but on a Friday afternoon, a hook and ladder truck brought all my neighbors out, and then Butch comes out on the gurney, his usual wonderful friendly self, oh, how you Frank, how you Joe, you know, doing his thing. You know, and I come out behind a newspaper like they won't know it's me, and you know, off we go to the police department, you know, and or up to the hospital, rather, and the nurses come out, and they say, he's so wonderful, we really like him, bring him back anytime, you know, they're just giving me all this stuff, and he's having a great old time back there, and they finally wheel him out to me in the wheelchair, and now he's not so friendly, and now he's not so funny, because he knows that I am angry with him, and this is where we're going now, because now I have to be, you know, he has to be angry back with me, and I remember getting him back home, and he told me he was going to go out and drink some more, and I literally flung my body in front of the front door, and I said, you'll go out over my dead body, and he pulled a knife on me, and I had a moment of clarity, and he got to go out and drink some more that night, and, you know, but I also kind of had a sanity switch go on there, you know, it was just kind of a like, you know, like I just had to turn him off for that night, you know, that didn't happen very often or much, but a lot of times I think God watches over so much more than what we know, so much more than what we know, and I think God was really watching over me that night, you know, and a few months later I decided obviously his problem is he doesn't have enough responsibility, we need some more children, you know, so I got pregnant with our second child, and you know, and somewhere in this whole episode, you know, while I was about 8 months pregnant, he was rifling through my purse looking for money, and he found the insurance card from our farmer's insurance agent, who was like 106 years old, you know, 3'5", no hit, not a hair on the man's body, and he accused this man of being the father of my unborn child, and because one more time he was looking for a reason to go out and drink. And I remember the next day I called the Council on Alcoholism. Now I don't have absolutely know why I did that. You know, I was never acknowledging that he was alcoholic or that alcohol was the problem, but I called the Council on Alcoholism. And I told this woman everything that happened in my house and all the stuff that had happened, and all she said to me was, I know, I know, I know, I know. And then she promised to send me some literature, and I'm sure that she did, and I remember getting an envelope in the mail, but I don't honestly remember opening it or looking at any of it. But that was my first attempt to reach out for help about, you know, that something was going on. What also happened in this part is that I was starting to look at alcoholism, and I was at a bookstore, and I found a book about, you know, one of those self-help books about drinking, and, you know, and I don't know how you are, but I just turned to the end of the book because I want to know how it ends, you know. And in the end of the book, I read about Ann abuse, you know, and I thought, boy, Ann, this is great. It's a pill. He likes pills. This will work, you know. So I went home, and I told him about Ann abuse, and he nodded his head. Off we went to the doctor, and he took Ann abuse for 2 years. You know, and I want you to know my husband didn't have a drop of alcohol to drink in that whole 2 year period. He took an exorbitant amount of drugs, but he did not have a drop of alcohol. And what I want you to know is that absolutely nothing changed in our house. Because what I know today is that we got rid of the alcohol, but we didn't touch the ism. And it was the ism that was killing our family. And after 2 years of taking Ann abuse, you know, the doctor took him off of it, and I remember leaving the doctor's office, and he says, I'm going to wait 6 months, and I'm going to try social drinking. And I know that we didn't go 6 days, and it was anything but social drinking. You know, and this is how I got to learn the hard way that alcoholism is a progressive disease, because I was totally unprepared for hardly any alcohol it took to get him as drunk, as angry, as just completely... You know, the last 9 months of my husband's drinking are a blackout for him and a total whiteout for me. It was just a total nightmare. It was absolute positive hell, and our life was not, nor our family was a pleasant place to be. You know, and I remember towards the very end of his drinking, standing toe-to-toe with him like I often did, yelling and screaming at him how much I hated him, how no good he was, what a failure he was. And I wasn't saying it in nice words. You know, I just was just right up. And I remember all of a sudden feeling both our children. And my one son was 5 and the other one was 3. And one was holding on to either side of me. And I looked down and they were both crying and they were begging me to stop yelling at their father. You know, and I'd like to tell you that I right away started going to Al-Anon and I had that moment of clarity. But I cannot report that to you, because what I'll tell you what I felt towards those children was anger that they dare interfere. that they dare interfere with how angry I was with his father, that they just better get off me before I smacked them too. And I want you to know that my husband, as drunk as he was, walked away. And I asked him where the hell he thought he was going. And he says, I'm leaving because of what I'm upsetting the children. And I don't tell you this because I'm proud of it. I tell you this to tell you where alcoholism took me, and I don't even drink. I love my children, and I took care of them in the physical sense. You know, they were cared for, they were washed, they were clean, they had food to eat. But they had no love, they had no affection from their mom, because I was always busy waiting for someone who might not be home for 4 days. Just never had time. I just couldn't bother. Not now, not now. Go away, don't bother me. Go to bed. You know, and I want you to know that everything that ever happened to those kids, any kind of little injury they ever got, I remember one time my one son was running around and he fell down and he hit the rocking chair and he got a big egg on his head. And Butch wasn't home that night, he was out drinking that night. But I want you to know the fact that that child, you know, got that egg on his head was all Butch's fault. Because see, he wasn't there, and if he was there, then I wouldn't have to be worrying about him and I could have been watching those kids better. Because if you're married to an alcoholic, at least it was my opinion, then you got a built-in excuse for every bad thought you ever have, for every bad thing you ever say, for every bad thing that ever comes out of your mouth. I blamed him for everything, absolutely, positively, and felt totally justified in it. And this is where alcoholism took me, and I don't even drink. You know, one night my husband got sober. I don't know why. I have absolutely no idea. He got arrested for drunk driving, which in our, you know, house is no big deal. He's been arrested lots of times. Now, one time prior to his getting sober, I did go to Al-Anon. I have a friend, Crazy Gene, and he's no longer alive, but he took me to an Al-Anon meeting, and I remember going to that Al-Anon meeting, and they were very nice to me, and it was, I suppose, a nice meeting. They had all the nice literature out, you know, but they didn't have the piece of literature that I want, and that's the piece that says how to get them sober and do what you want them to do, because that's all I'm interested in. You know, they were telling me stuff like, this is a program for you. You can be happy whether the alcoholic gets sober or not. You have to learn to live your life whether the alcoholic gets sober or not. But see, I didn't want to hear any of that. Absolutely none. There was nothing wrong with me. Once the alcoholic gets sober, my life will be fine. Thank you very much. And that was just my attitude towards that meeting. So this particular night when my husband got arrested, like I say, it was no big deal. On a scale of 1 to 10, you know, of drunks, this was maybe a 5 or a 6. It just wasn't that big of a deal. But something had happened that night, and this is how I know that God was working in his life, even though God was not working in mine. Because I called the hospital that night, and I found out about this program they had for alcoholism. And they told me I could have my husband committed if he were drunk, but after 48 hours, if he didn't want to stay, he wouldn't have to. And they gave me the name of the doctor that was on call that night. You know, and I did something I hadn't done in a long time. I put on pajamas and went to bed. Because, see, I'm up to staying up all night and smoking cigarettes and laying on the couch and waiting and waiting and waiting. But that night I went to bed, and around, you know, 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the Redondo Beach police called me, and they had him, you know, and I could hear him in the back, oh, call my wife, you know, like they always do. And but they had to keep him, you know, 8 hours or whatever. And I guess sometime during that night is when God moved in on my husband's life. And he had something happen to him that night. And that's his story. But what I do know is that when I picked him up in the morning, there was a different person standing there. An absolutely positively different person. Because usually he was really angry and hostile at the police for arresting law-abiding citizens like himself who were only having, you know, a couple of friendly drinks and at 1:30 in the morning and then driving. But that was always, you know, he was always just real hostile about it, and he was not. But how I really know that God was working in his life is I didn't say anything. And believe you me, it takes a power greater than anything you have ever seen to keep my mouth shut when I am, you know, just totally armed and full of ammunition. And now I have the number of this hospital in my pocket. But I said nothing. And I remember even driving, look, you know, we had to go truck hunting. I don't know if you've ever done that, but, you know, we had to go find the lost truck. And, you know, it's a really big thing. They lose them, though. And, but we found it, and he wanted to get something to eat, and I took him to get some breakfast, and again, I said nothing. We got home, he went upstairs, he was upstairs for 2 days, I never bothered him, never said boo to him, and then he came downstairs and he says, I think I have a problem drinking, and I need some help. You know, and I gave him the number of this hospital, you know, and that's how, again, how I know God was working in his life, because I had absolutely nothing to do with making the arrangements or calling the hospital or doing anything. I even left the room when he made the phone call. You know, this is how God was working in Butch's life. And I remember taking him to this hospital, and they had to put him in the psychiatric unit because he had this long-standing Valium habit they had to detox him off of first. And And as I was getting ready to leave, you know, I was really getting kind of concerned because for sure people would know I wasn't a good picker now, and now that he's in the psychiatric unit of this hospital. And he called me back, and I was thought for sure it was because he changed his mind and he didn't want to stay. And instead he reached into his pocket and he handed me the Valium that he brought in case of emergency. You know, and I went home and I took it because I was just a basket case. And he was in that hospital for, you know, he was in the psychiatric unit for 2 or 3 weeks. You know, again, that was a real difficult time for me. You know, I have a husband in the psychiatric unit, and I've got a child in kindergarten and one in preschool. So I would take what the children had made, you know, in kindergarten and preschool to cheer him up. But he never wanted to see what they made. He wanted to show me what he'd done in occupational therapy that day, you know, and I should take that home to the children. And it was just really crazy, and he was making beer steins and belt buckles, and he was whacked and having the time of his life. And I'm there trying to hold it all together, the big, strong mother, the wonderful wife, you know, doing the thing. And then they introduced him to the alcoholic side of that, you know, hospital, and he got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was home. He was absolutely positively home, and he fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous from the very beginning. And I'm very pleased to say that last July he celebrated 15 years of continuous sobriety, of which I am truly, truly grateful. And again, they introduced me to Al-Anon. They said, you should go to a meeting. They didn't have this intense family stuff going on back then. So I am a rule follower, so I went to a meeting. And again, my attitude was, I've won. He's sober, nanny, nanny, nanny. I came to you once, asked you how to get him sober. You didn't tell me nothing. So I ain't going to tell you how I got him sober, you know. I wasn't quite sure what I was done, but I was willing to take credit for it completely, believe you me. You know, and so he started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I went with him in the beginning to make sure he heard the stuff he was supposed to hear. He's not very bright. And I loved Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I positively loved the laughter. It was so nice to hear laughter in our life. And I really enjoyed it. And they made me feel very welcome and loved at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I had a great time. But after 6 months of going to meetings, I got tired of going to AA meetings all the time. You know, and I thought he should start, you know, come on, get, you know, there's only 12 steps. How stupid are you? You know, what's the deal here? You know, how long is this going to take? But he made it clear to me that Alcoholics Anonymous was the most important thing in his life. I'm sure his sponsor said, go home and tell your wife that, she will love it. Because it went over like a lead balloon at my house, believe you me. Because, you know, what happened was, if he's getting a program and he's getting recovery and he has steps to work and he has a sponsor, and I have none of this in my life, absolutely none at all. You know, and I had always thought that when he was sober, I'll be okay. When he's a good husband, I'll be okay. When he's a good father, I'll be fine. When he brings home a paycheck, I'll be fine. And he was doing all these things and way, way more than I ever thought he could do, and I was not fine. I was still angry and hostile and picking a fight every possible chance I got. And no matter how many times I tried to pick fights with him, he would say stuff to me like, easy does it, you know, one day at a time. And my absolute topper favorite, let go and let God. And I would just want to wring his sober neck like you just cannot believe. You know, and what was happening for me is I was becoming fearful. Because, see, I'd always thought I was saving this spot in life for Butch. I'm waiting for Butch to just catch up with me. And what was happening is Butch was passing me and I was getting really scary. You know, because he is a wonderful person. And this wonderful person was coming out again. Not just because he was sober, but because he was working a program in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was getting scared. You know, and I would go to meetings with him occasionally, anniversary meetings or special meetings and stuff like that, and the AA ladies would come up to me and they would go, are you Butch's wife? And I go, yes, I am. And they go, well, we just love him. We think he's so wonderful. And I'm like, you know. Chapter 5, how it works. You get him sober and an AA woman steals him away from you. There we go. That was my version of what was going on. And see, that was a real fear for me, because I tell you what I saw in alcoholic women at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and that was attractive women. Attractive women working a program like he was working a program. Nice women. And it was getting scary for me. You know, because it's like my friend Crazy Jean used to say, you know, it's like they get sober and you're out of a job. You know, and that's just how I felt, like I was out of a job. What can I do anymore? You know, he's doing just fine without any help from me. And that is a real scary place, to be. You know, and occasionally he would mention to me about going to Al-Anon. Lars, why don't you try Al-Anon? you know, and I'd say, listen, if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous for the rest of your life, you won't have as much maturity as I have in this baby finger right now. You know, and I want you to know after almost 14 years now and on, this is where all my maturity is, right here in this baby finger. I finally learned that here. But what ended up happening is after he was 2 years sober, he was going to go to Palm Springs to the Roundup. And I could go or not go, but he was going. You know, and up to this point, for 2 years, I'd nixed any conventions. It was too much money, and we couldn't afford to do that kind of stuff. But he was going to go, and I could go or not go. You know, and I had to go because I couldn't leave him with all those women, those AA women running around in bikinis trying to steal him, you know. So I went to go watch him and make sure he was okay and that he came home. And while we were at that convention, he talked me into going to the family meeting. And while we were at the family meeting, they had an AA speaker, an Al-Anon speaker, and an Alateen speaker. And believe you me, I didn't go to that meeting, you know, because I wanted anything to do with Al-Anon or Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to watch him. But I must have let my guard down, you know. And if you are new here, that's the only thing I can really tell you, is that you have to have some willingness. There has to be some open-mindedness, even if it's only this much, but that's all it takes. But there has to be some. The first time I went to that first Al-Anon meeting, I was totally closed. I wasn't open to anything. I didn't want to hear anything. But maybe after being exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous for 2 years, you know, something opened in me about this much, you know, when the seed of this program got planted. You know, when we came back from that convention, I started going to Al-Anon meetings. And I went to Al-Anon meetings. I'm so fortunate because I went for all the right reasons. I didn't go to get him sober. He already was. I didn't go to keep him sober. He was doing a great job all by himself. I went because I was still had all this rage and anger and frustration inside me, and I did not know what to do with it anymore. And I was this mean and vindictive person, and I didn't like who I had become. And I know that I needed help. You know, when I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, you know, I heard stuff like, you got to work the steps and you got to get a sponsor. And I am a rule follower, so I just jumped right into it. You know, one of the first meetings I went to was a step study meeting, and boy, they got you going on those steps right off the bat. And I got a sponsor right away because they said that's what you're supposed to do. And I want you to know my very first sponsor, I just thought, boy, I'd made a huge mistake. She was a secret member of Alcoholics Anonymous for sure, because she was always making me make amends to Butch all the time. You know, and I could never understand that. And just to give you an example of how she was, one morning Butch went down to start his truck and it wouldn't start, and so I had to jump him because his battery was dead. And as soon as I jumped his battery, he ran out of gas, and this made him angry, and he yelled at me, and I did what I always do. I yelled right back at him. He went storming off to work, and I went upstairs and called my sponsor to report him. And I told her, you know, everything that had happened, and she says, when he gets home tonight, you apologize for the words that came out of your mouth. You know, so I told her the story all over again, you know, obviously. Not all sponsors are that quick here either, and I told her the story again, and about halfway through she stopped me and she says, it doesn't matter anymore what Butch says or does. What I am concerned about is what comes out of your mouth and the things that you do, and that is what I want you to be concerned about from now on as well. And for your behavior, when your husband comes home tonight, you owe him amends. You know, so I learned a couple things about that whole thing. First of all, never call your sponsor in the morning because you got all day long to think about it. You know, and I knew I was going to see my sponsor that night at the meeting, and I knew she would ask me if I had done this, and so I had to think about it all day. So when Butch got home that night, I told him I was sorry I let his crappy attitude affect me the way that it had. And but see, this program's about practice. Practice, practice, practice. You know, nobody starts off really good, you know, but the point is that you start, is that you make an attempt. And even as feeble as that was an attempt. Because see, up until that time, I'd never ever told him I was sorry for anything. And I had to learn that in this program. I had to learn that I have responsibilities too, that I played a part in a lot of the stuff that went on, that I got to take responsibility for that I got to clean up the wreckage of my past as well. You know, and that was a really precious lesson that I learned from my sponsor, and I am really, really grateful for that. You know, people were not nice to me when I got here. I am what I like to refer to as I was a hostile whiner, which means I whined a lot, but I was so angry all the time no one would really call me on it, you know, because I just, bleh. And one time when I was at a meeting and we were again on the first step, and why the first step doesn't apply to me, I'm always real big on why this doesn't apply and why that doesn't apply. And after the meeting I was whining in my hostile way to Crazy Jean, you know, about how, you know, this is stupid and da 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 da. And Jean says to me, you know, Larsine, why God gave you ears you know, yes, Jean, so I can hear what you guys say to me. And he goes, well, in most instances, that's true, but in your case, God gave you ears so you'd have something to hold on to while you yank your head out of your butt. And I was shocked. But it was true. You know, I had my head up there for so long, I couldn't hear anything anybody was saying. And again, I am so grateful. They would say stuff to me like, get off the cross, we need the wood. You know, I mean, that's just how whiny I was about that kind of stuff. And they gave me the ability to laugh at myself. They gave me the ability to see me for who I really was and not who this big martyr suffering person who I had made up in my mind was. You know, and my career in Al-Anon so far, I want you to know, has been this much at a time. Absolutely, positively, only this much. You know, it's just, I'm the one who makes it hard for me, but, you know, for whatever reason, it's the way that I have to go. I don't know why I have to make myself suffer as I do, but for some reason I do. But that's just kind of how I started out. But I want you to know that over the course of time, that if you take, you know, a bunch of this many and you put them together, then you start getting this much and you start getting this much. And you start growing in this program without even realizing and without even knowing that things are going on. You know, and the first indication I got that anything was changing in my life was after I was in the program for over a year. And we were going to one of these, you know, fabulous potlucks we always have, and I'd made this lemon dessert, and the crust was kind of raised up and it had burnt, you know, and I couldn't take burnt crust to a potluck, God forbid, you know, so I very gently cut it all with the knife and I kind of tilted it over the sink and I blew, you know, and then the whole dessert went sliding right down into the garbage disposal. For that fraction of a second, I can get it out of the garbage disposal and back in the pan, you know, thought crossed my mind, you know. But then what happened to me was the most marvelous thing that has ever happened to me in this program, and that's that I just started to laugh. There was nobody else around, just me, and I just started to laugh. And that's when I just felt all that hatred, all that anger, and all that resentment finally just start to ooze out. The real gift is the ability to laugh at yourself. It's okay. It's not that big of a deal. Stop making it that big of a deal. You know, Butch and I have been really, really fortunate in this program. We've had so many wonderful experiences. We have met so many wonderful people. Our life has been just really, I never would have imagined anything like this. You know, when I first got here, there's no way you could have told me you could have repaid me for all the suffering I had endured, you know, absolutely positively not. Heck, within the first months of Al-Anon, you know, there's no way I could make up all the gifts that I have been given in this program. You know, our life has not been perfect, but our life has been wonderful, absolutely positively. When I was in Al-Anon about 7 years, I got one of those calls in the middle of the night that my sister Lucy had been killed in an automobile crash. And this is my sister that's just right behind me. And my sister had been in the Narcotics Anonymous for a few months, but she decided that that really wasn't her problem and that she never did have a drinking problem. And she was up in Oregon when she was killed in this accident. And I want you to know that was absolutely positively the worst day of my whole entire life was when I got that phone call. And I was so overcome with grief, just absolutely beside myself. And I want you to know my sister was whacked. She was just a crazy, nuts person. But, you know, I wouldn't have put it past my sister at where she was in her disease to fake her own death, to lie about her own death, you know, so I made my husband call the police department up in Oregon to make sure that she had indeed been killed. And when he came into the bedroom to tell me that she was, I got up and I went into the bathroom and I got on my knees and I asked God to please help me. You know, and I didn't ask God to make my sister be alive again, because that's not a fair prayer. I just asked him to help me. And, you know, and this is how you know, I don't have big spiritual awakening. Things like that don't happen for me. But for a fraction of a moment, I really did feel God's presence. I really did feel that it's okay, that you will be okay, that she will be okay. It just lasted for a fraction of a second. You know, then I went back into my, you know, big upset thing and whatever. And I got to take my mom up to Oregon to go get my sister's body and to collect my sister's children, who were the same age as my children. And I got to bring them back down here. And we got to have a funeral for my sister. And my sister is she's a drug addict. She's a thief. She had several warrants out for her arrest. So, you know, all her pusher friends and the court system didn't really see fit to come to her funeral. But I'll tell you who came to her funeral. Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon came to her funeral. And And they supported me, and they supported my husband. And they walked us through that, and they supported my sister. You know, and I have since talked too much to God about my sister dying. I've told her who I want her sponsor to be in heaven. And you know, it's never going to be okay. I can go to Al-Anon for the rest of my life, for 10,000 lives. I'm never going to like the fact that my sister is no longer alive. Because to me, that's the scariest thing in Al-Anon, is that the people that we love won't get sober and that they'll die behind this disease. And I'm here to tell you, it happens. It just plain old does. But we have a program to work, and we have other people to love us. And I've got tons of sisters in Alcoholics Anonymous today who I love very much, who I look at upon like my sister, who I talk to about my sister. You know, and that's a real gift from AA, and I am really, truly, truly grateful for that. Our boys are now 21 and 18 years old. You know, when Butch first went in the hospital, they told me that alcoholism is a hereditary disease, and they were 5 and 3 when their dad got sober. So when I went home, I made them both raise their right hand and swear to me they wouldn't be alcoholic. And they did. They nodded their head. And I cannot stand before you today and tell you that they're alcoholic. But I will tell you that some of the things that they're doing right now really bothers me, and it's really, really painful for me. Last month, our youngest son, who's 18 years old, came to his dad and I and told us that he's had a 5-year ongoing acid and pot habit. And we get to work through that with him. We get to do whatever we get to do to hold our family together. And I'm so grateful to this program for all the tools they have given me. Because what we have in our home is we have children who can come to us and tell us the stuff that's going on in their lives. And even if we don't like it, and even as painful as it is, I don't have to do it alone. And I'm just going to share with you, when my oldest son was 17 years old, he announced to us that he also had a drinking problem, and he joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And we turned him over to these other people, and he went to Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 months. And he announced to me that he wasn't in Alcoholics Anonymous anymore when he came home one night and puked all over his bedroom. And my husband happened to be out of town on a camping trip. You know, I want you to know that night, with 9 years in Al-Anon, I sure didn't feel like no black belt Al-Anon. My heart was breaking. Because watching someone you love kill themselves is not a fun thing, no matter how much Al-Anon you have or what is going on. But I worked my program, I called my sponsor, and I went to my meetings, and I did what I was supposed to do. And I did that for a few months, and I did really, really well. And then all of a sudden, but see, I was doing the stuff I was supposed to do, but he didn't join AA again. He wasn't getting his act together again. So I started reverting back to my old behavior. And what I ended up doing was stuffing what I, not telling you guys, not being honest with you about what I was doing. And our house was becoming a not once more pleasant place to live in because of my ranting and raging and carrying on. But I was going to Al-Anon. How's it going? Fine. I'm doing good. You'd be proud of me. One time I dropped Butch off at his meeting, and I went on to my meeting. And just before he shut the car door, he says, "You really need to share at your meeting." So I told him to mind his own business and work his own program, and I'll work mine, thank you very much. And I went to that meeting, and I had absolutely no intention of sharing a thing. But see, what happened that night is the leader didn't show up, so they asked me to lead. You know, and to me, that's God tapping me on the shoulder today. I feel those taps today, and if I don't ignore them, then I get to act on them, and I know that there's something going on. I think God tapped me on the shoulder lots of times, but I just always brushed it off. But I felt his tap that night. And what ended up happening is that I got to read the opening where it talks how we become nervous and irritable without knowing it. Why? Because we try and force solutions. You know, force solutions. It was just crystal clear to me. I've read that 100 times. But I got to read it the first time that night. And then I got to share with those guys what was going on in my life. And again, they didn't come to me and say, "Oh, Larson, you idiot, you should do this and this and this and everything will work out." Because see, there's no guarantees. I don't know why I thought that if I come to the program and I work really hard and I sponsor people and I go to meetings and I read the literature and I do all that stuff, it doesn't mean that everybody else is going to be okay. It doesn't mean my kids are going to go to Harvard and, you know, and they're going to thank their mother personally from the podium for everything she ever did from them. But that's what I think should be going on. It doesn't say that anywhere. It says that we will be happy, regardless of whether the alcoholic is drinking or not. And they got to remind me of that. And they got to remind me that I didn't have to do this by myself, that I wasn't alone. you know, how you thank people for that, I don't know. I absolutely don't know. But because of them, you know, it always amazes me that I had to go to Al-Anon and go to perfect strangers to learn how to love my family. You guys taught me how to love my husband and my children, something I thought that should come naturally to me, but and maybe would have, but was destroyed by the effects of alcoholism on my life. But you guys gave me back that. So today I know how to love my family. I know how to be a good mom and I know how to be a good wife. But I don't no longer have to enable or participate in unacceptable behavior. And sometimes that's a real fine line and I'm not sure which way I'm supposed to go. So I call my sponsor and she always tells me the same thing. Pray about it. Turn it over. Answers will come. And they always do. You know, how can I thank you guys for that? I am just so really truly grateful. I just want to close with my favorite page in the One Day at a Time. Because the first time I read this, it just really spoke out to me. And whenever I'm in a bad place and whenever I'm in a good place, and almost every day I read this page because they wrote it for me. It's January the 21st. If I can see myself clearly and honestly in relation to my present circumstances, I will not become the victim of self-pity or resentment. If I do what I should, I will be at peace with myself. It is only when I compare my lot in life with that of others that the destructive emotion of self-pity is allowed to engulf me. It is only by taking offense at what others do that I will be afflicted with resentment. If I feel that what I am doing is right, I will not be dependent on the admiration or applause of others. It is gratifying but not essential to my contentment. I will learn to judge my own motives, to evaluate my own actions, so that little by little I can bring them into line with my standards and ideals. Nothing has the power to hurt my feelings and stir up unwholesome emotions in me unless I allow it. I will do what is given me to do. I will do it as well as I can. That will be my inner security against which all outside battering will be powerless. Labor not as one who is wretched, nor yet as one who would be pitied or admired. Direct yourself to one thing only, to put yourself in motion, and to check yourself at all times. Thanks a lot for having me.